This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Hello, good evening and welcome. I'm Alec Hoggett. It's my great pleasure to be your host tonight as we go through the big news of the day, starting in the Middle East. Where else? Well, our top story tonight has got two prongs to it. We're going to kick off first with our partners at the Financial Times of London. Kasia Brazalian is the host of the FT News Briefing, and she catches up here with her colleague, the Beirut correspondent of the FT, Raya Jalabi. Let's listen in.
Rebel groups toppled Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and his regime on Sunday. It was a stunning capitulation. Opposition fighters marched from north to south and into the heart of Damascus in just a handful of days. Joining me now from the Syrian capital is the FT's Raya Jalabi. Hi, Raya.
Hi.
So we're talking to you Sunday evening local time. What's it been like there?
So I drove into Damascus earlier today from Beirut, where I live in Lebanon, and it was a bit of a manic journey to get here because no one saw the regime falling this fast. So the road from Beirut to Damascus usually takes about 2 hours. There was not a single Syrian soldier anywhere to be seen. There was no customs, there was no immigration, there was nothing. And we drove straight across the border, and littered all across the street leading into the city were abandoned armored military vehicles. So you had tanks that had been abandoned by the side of the road, and lots of them still had the soldiers' belongings still inside. And as we continued into the city, I was met with scenes of jubilation. I saw hundreds of people sort of celebrating, they were dancing, they were singing, and there was a lot of celebratory gunfire. But there's also incredible fear and trepidation because this is yet another tumultuous chapter in Syria's complicated history.
Can you back up and tell me about this rebel offensive?
So it's hard to underscore just how monumental the last 10 days have been for Syria and for the region at large. It seems as though HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is this Islamist faction based in the north, has been ruling Idlib province for much of the past 7 years. They seem to have been planning an offensive for some time now. And essentially what they did was they barreled from their stronghold in Idlib province all the way in the northwest and started thundering down south. And they started with Aleppo, they continued on to Homs, and then they said, well, we're on our way to Damascus within the next few days. And it was really hard for many of us to believe that that was going to be the case, because this is a regime that has shown us the level of brutality and repression they're willing to leverage on their citizens every time that they try to rebel. So there was a massive expectation that there would be some kind of hard military comeback from the regime side. But the regime forces at every turn just melted away.
And to what extent is the wider regional conflict that we've been seeing contributing to the factors here that these rebels were able to do this so quickly?
Well, I think it played a huge role. We're still sort of unpacking what exactly has happened in the last 10 days. But essentially, up until 2015, it looked as though the regime could have fallen. But ultimately, Russia came in and Iran came in and sent in Hezbollah. And that allowed Bashar al-Assad to stay in power. And I suppose, given the chaos in the region after a war in neighboring Israel and an ensuing war in Lebanon, the rebels seemed to have taken their moment and launched this offensive. I mean, as the rebels saw it, Iran and Hezbollah were distracted with their own conflict and therefore weren't going to be able to put up a robust defense. And likewise for Russia, which is one of Assad's main backers, they've been bogged down in their own conflict in Ukraine for the past 2 years. So there's been very little support come in from these international forces that we've been led to believe for more than a decade were steadfast in their support for Bashar al-Assad.
Is there any indication of who might rule Syria?
It's not clear who is going to rule. I mean, what HTS has done in Idlib province in the northwest has been to establish a civilian administration over the last few years. And so that civilian administration takes care of the day-to-day business of the country. But ultimately, the ruler of that province is still considered to be Abu Muhammad al-Jolani, who is the head of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. He's the head of that most important and most powerful rebel group. So he certainly sees himself as the future leader of Syria. But today, in an appearance in Damascus, he called for a transitional period for Syria and hinted at a democratic future. So We don't really know, but for now, I think he will play a very important role in Syria, and who's to say who will take over politically?
Wow. Well, why are we giving it so much airtime? No, it's the big international story of the moment. It's a regime that's been in power for 54 years, a father and son, who have really dominated, and he's the only person on earth, apparently, who has Assad, who has given his own people a taste of chemical weapons. I had the chance to meet a lot of the Syrian activists in Davos a few years ago, and my goodness, they were under a lot of pressure there. Many people, more than 500,000 people have been killed. But the implications for South Africa are significant, and here's why. The ANC has brought Iran, the regime of Iran, into BRICS. Now, the regime of Iran, for those of you who've been following our coverage on the subject, from Iraj Abedian, who you're going to hear from in just a moment, that regime is deeply unpopular with its own people. It only has about 10% of the people who support it, and in fact, it's applied very, very heavy regulations coming from a tiny sect in Islam. So it's not Islam, it's a little sect, a little portion of Islam. That's the first thing. The second thing is MTN has the license for cell phones, or has a license for cell phones in Iran, which allegedly, the Turks say, was through bribery, and the Turks were the ones who lost. Now, this whole regime change that's happened in Syria is very relevant because MTN used to have the cell phone license in Syria. It recently pulled out. The company is still called MTN Syria that operates, even though MTN apparently doesn't own anything anymore. And what surprises me is the MTN share price today was only down 1%. It's, in fact, up by 5% in the last 6 months, and was up nearly 2% in the past month as all of these ructions have been happening. So if you're an MTN shareholder, I suggest you take a deep breath and you go and have a look at what's going on there. And we get more of that now from Iraj Abedian. Iraj is Iranian-born and raised, came to South Africa. He is a South African, came here at the age of about 20, has spent 45 years here, much of it as a professor of economics at the University of Cape Town, the spokesperson in many ways as the chief economist at Standard Bank, in the last 20 years as an entrepreneur. His links with Iran are deep, and he knows the region better probably than anybody else, certainly that I talked to in South Africa. Let's get Iraj's take on these dramatic developments over the weekend.
One hopes that over the past 40-odd years in the Middle East, people have learned that unless the transition from authoritarian, brutal regimes of one kind or another becomes conducive to the celebration of diversity and peaceful coexistence, nobody can win and everybody will lose. Syria, as I mentioned, historically hasn't been religiously a demagogue or radical by any stretch of imagination. It has been a group of creative entrepreneurs, traders, philosophers, and really the hotbed of cultural development, music, etc., etc. If they can dig deep into that history, to that culture, they will be able to have a government of national unity in a true sense of the word. And Turkey seemed to at the moment, play that song. Yesterday, I was listening to the foreign minister of Turkey, and he was very much very firmly saying, we need to have a government of national unity. Turkey will not tolerate segmentation of the territorial integrity of Syria, etc., etc. These are all the good notes coming from Turkey, which no doubt, in collaboration with the United States, are underpinning these developments.
Which brings us to South Africa. It looks like we've backed the wrong horse here in a very big way. And I say we, perhaps we should be more specific and say the ANC.
Well, our foreign affairs and the ANC up until last year. So yes, they're cozying up to a regime in Iran that has this well-known ideology, strategic thrust, destabilization, elimination of all people at all costs. and their way or highway, that kind of documented. These are not hypothesized or hypothesis or speculation. These are documented by the United Nations. To getting close to a regime that can happily wipe out 500,000 human beings in Syria, imprison its own nations, treat people, as I mentioned last time, women particularly. Remember that the mullahs in Iran have got two pillars on their ideology, elimination of Israel and subjugation of women. These two are non-negotiable for them. Now, these are the very two principles that's contrary to not only to our constitution, to any basic requirements of sustainability over time. Assad was powerful for 54 years, as you mentioned, but it collapsed. Iran may look, or Iranian regime may look very powerful, but when it becomes porous, when its values are no longer coherent and in sync with the people's support, where they lose 90 or 80% of citizens' support, when people are impoverished and so on, rest assured, Alec, it can collapse. It will collapse. Not because of my views, because basic principles of sustainability are not there. A government that is bankrupt, brutal, and pursues an ideology irrespective of its cost to its nation, irrespective of the cost to the region, etc., etc., and at the moment is quite marginalized in the Middle East. A year ago, they were dominant. 2 years ago, they were feared because of what they could do in every land that they wanted. Today, they are marginalized, defeated, not just ideologically, military, and otherwise, but defeated by economic forces. I cannot emphasize as an economist the importance of how terrible the conditions of Iranians, average Iranians, the majority of people are, despite the fact that they should be one of the most prosperous nations on the planet because of their resourcefulness. And yet, all those resources are used to destabilize the region, and the region has now taken a position. They are not going to tolerate it. They're going to push back, and that's exactly what's happening. So for us to protect the interests of South Africa, because there is a phenomenal capacity, really deep bilaterally beneficial trade and investment opportunities, but we cannot cozy up to a regime that is so disliked, hated, and opposed by the predominant majority of the nation.
Well, I guess it's no surprise to many South Africans, given this country's involvement in BRICS, that Assad, the dictator, the man whose family ran that country into the ground, Syria, this is, for the last 54 years, has fled to Moscow. Neil De Beer, and on his Sunday show with Chris Stein, is always great to watch. You can pick up Neil De Beer's interview, the Sunday show. You can also pick up the Monday show, which is the Monday sports show with Rory Stein, and the full Iraj Abedian interview on BizNews TV on YouTube. So lots of watching for you later later this evening. But Neil was asked to give his views on Helen Ziller, the federal chair of the Democratic Alliance. And what came out might surprise you.
I don't care what people say. I am a huge fan of Helen. I have been a friend of Helen Ziller. I've had my ups and downs. I've had my battles on twist, but one thing I'll give, she doesn't take nonsense. And people will say she must go, and people will say her time is past and she's lost it a little bit. I don't care. I like that little bit of lost. Now, every single week, Frikki Fikile sits there and says another chirp to the GNU and go as far as saying last week that the DA can go. You know, we're okay. What kind of la-la land or substance is this man taking that he can continually think that the ANC is now past the traumatic disaster and is again in charge? Heiligman, we all know that the current turn, even minute, of the economy of this country may I say, a little bit of a better feeling. And I'm going to say it, and you know I'm not a member, but it's the DA. It is the GNU. You can say what you will. And this is a fact. Now, Helen, every single time, comes up with a rebuff, which is typical her, straight to the point, fatty nonsense, ne? And she says in an interview, I just want to make it very clear to the ANC that leaving the GNU, and here comes the genius within the sentence, that that is my nuclear option.
Ew.
Now, Chris, if you understand war, if you understand military maneuver, if you understand armory, and if you understand the global war game, the ultimate of such a matter of finality has always been the threat of a nuclear war and who will push the button first. So her analogy is as follows. If we walk out of this GNU, when you drop a nuclear bomb, Nagasaki, Hiroshima, the fact is it's over and you can only use that on that system once. You can't come back again. Does next. So I found it very unique by her chirp back to say it's my nuclear option. The fact that she says it, therefore knows that she has it. Therefore, she understands it. In die knoppie, she knows where it is. And the scale of balance of continually telling the ANC that you are not prominent, you don't like us, there's a split in the ANC, GNU and the RDT, and that the GNU will continually talking so that we can keep it together. I'm saying 2027, benchmark. And at this current moment, because we need to start doing something to protect ourselves against the MK onslaught and the continual crack within that system of the ANC.
Wow. Well, you're going to be able to see Chris and Neil together live on stage at the Biz News Conference in March 2020. In other words, what's that, 4 months' time. Also at the event will be Helen Ziller. It'll be interesting to see how Neil and Helen engage there. Paul Mashatile will be opening it, the deputy president. Gayton McKenzie has confirmed he will be there as well. And that's just the politicians. Adrian Gore, Rob Hersoff, there's a whole strand, the We Buy Cars team. Well, I guess Farn is the one who's going to be taking the stage, Farn van der Walt. Lots of entrepreneurs, lots of fantastic knowledge that'll be handed out there. If you haven't got your ticket yet, go for it, because we're already two-thirds booked and it's still 4 months to go. On to the next conversation here. And South African-born men are making big strides in the United States. You can look at the LA Times. Mr. Sun Yung, you can have a look at, of course, Elon Musk, by far the wealthiest man in the world. But the next guy to emerge is one David Sachs. Now, it's from an old South African family, long-time South African family, who left when David was five. So I guess we can't really claim him anymore. But he surely does leave and exhibit those South African roots. He has been appointed by Donald Trump as the new crypto and AI czar in the United States. So a little bit of South Africa in another very high position in Washington. Let's have a look in at how our partners at Bloomberg are assessing him.
Who exactly is David Sachs, this new AI crypto czar? I've heard that he's part of the PayPal mafia, and he does, he is venture capitalist. There's some software businesses there. Is he intimately tied to crypto?
Yeah, the important thing to note here is that he has been supportive of crypto, for a while now, as well as in the AI space. We had reported previously that there would be this crypto czar. It was unclear at the time whether that would be combined with this AI czar role. We now know it is. And again, that points to how far, these emerging technologies and how big of a role they'll play. with Trump's administration. And this is really capping what has been a turnaround in terms of his relationship with crypto, right? Originally, he was skeptical of it. On the campaign trail, he was, saying that he would fire Gensler, and now we have Atkins, who is supportive of it. So Sachs, just like him, a supporter financially of Trump, a supporter of crypto, and really helped bring in not just the crypto industry to donate, but also younger men in general, and broaden that demographic.
No, absolutely. And that's what we saw kind of push him into electoral victory. So from what I understand, Hadriana, this is not a paid full-time position, AI/crypto czar, where he has to disclose publicly and possibly divest his holdings as well, but more of a special advisory role. How do they then prevent any potential conflicts of interest?
Right. So as you had mentioned, what he has been appointed to, this Presidential Council of Advisors for Science and Technology, that is what's known as a federal advisory committee, which is essentially set up so that people with private sector expertise can advise the government without divesting their assets. And so this is something where, and we've reached out to Kraft, he will not step down from Kraft. So there's definitely going to be some conversation in terms of how to maintain, maintain the, separation, and that there aren't any instances of him having those conflicts of interest. And so that's something that we're going to continue to report out. Mm. But of course, as you mentioned, he will not be leaving Kraft. It's similar to Musk, who he will work alongside. And again, it's someone close to Vance, someone that could speak to some of his influence in terms of all of these rollouts of the different appointees.
Well, the South African, what they call him, the PayPal mafia, just getting stronger and stronger, the South African connection there. It's extraordinary, really, when you look at our country and the talent that we have here. Let's just hope we can hold on to the next generation, keep them in the country, and let the David Sachses and the Elon Musks build our country rather than doing what they're doing for America. Well, somebody who thinks he's got the answer is Phil Craig. He's the leader of the Referendum Party. The Referendum Party is the promoters of Cape independence. They didn't do very well in the last election, but he says patience is required. I had a fascinating interview with Phil today. It's our premiere tonight at 8 o'clock. So if Cape independence is of any interest to you, I suggest you get in front of that goggle box and pick it up at 8 o'clock. It'll be on the Biz News TV on YouTube. But let's listen to a highlight of the conversation from today with Phil Craig.
No, look, and I think our fight has really not been in vain. I think we fundamentally changed the political landscape. We might not have got votes and got into Parliament yet. But what we absolutely have done is we've established Cape independence. It's on the political landscape. Created this much more vibrant discussion then around devolution and federalism. And actually, it's interesting, when I look forward as a party, so what do we look forward to in the future? Well, I mean, the politician that inspires me, and when I talk to people in our party, I say, look, who's the politician that we should most be like? Well, the answer, I always say, is Helen Sussman. There was one MP against 400. You would say it was impossible odds, but who won? Because eventually you just have to be there. You just have to resist all of the insults and the put downs and just keep saying your message, because eventually you can't run away from truth. And I think that's our situation here. Our job is not to get deflated. Our job is not to people want us to hang up the towel. They desperately want me to leave the country. They want us, but we're not. We've got no intention of doing that. We're here, and we're going to keep on saying it, and we're going to keep on saying it, and we're going to be ever present, and increasingly more and more people will come to us. And one of the fascinating things, ironically, and obviously I definitely won't name names, but in this election, I can't tell you how many really senior figures in civil society phoned me up personally and said, I voted Referendum Party. It was totally awe-inspiring. And it was almost like, okay, well, the intellectuals have got this, the people who are kind of in the know. But actually, what we haven't been able to do is get down to the voting masses. And that kind of makes sense. When we ran our focus groups, we had this really fascinating thing that happened. We ran our focus groups for the election. And we ran them for DA voters because we were primarily targeting DA voters. And we asked them, would they vote for anybody else? And no, they said, no, they vote for the DA. Why did they vote for the DA? Almost every single group said, well, when my pipe burst, the exact example, when my pipe burst, the DA came. And then we said, okay, describe us the kind of future you would like to live in South Africa. And everybody wanted, yeah, they wanted a safe country. They wanted quality services, healthcare, education. They wanted low unemployment. They wanted to reduce poverty. They wanted end to race-based policy. And we asked DA voters, do you believe the DA can deliver that? Almost, I mean, more than 90% of DA voters don't believe the DA can deliver the future they want. Yeah, well, all they can do is sort of manage their conditions now and make them as comfortable as possible. Palliative care, should we call it? And I think when that penny drops, that's when this, because we're never going to get 50% of the vote. We're not interested in 50% of the vote. What we actually do is get into Parliament and get enough leverage for us to be having these debates that you and I are having now on the floor of Parliament and much more in the public eye so that people can, the penny starts to drop. Well, why would we submit to being a permanent minority in a unitary majoritarian regime? What's the point? Particularly when we have an absolute right to assert ourselves. I mean, it's just absolute insanity. But at this point in time, it's not something that people have been willing to vote for, which is a shame.
Phil Craig, the leader of the Referendum Party, playing the long game. Well, let's get on to the markets and how they performed today. Resources did best, 3.5% firmer. I think an implication there, or a knock-on effect of the stabilization of the Middle East, perhaps at last, with the ousting of Assad. It really is a big deal. And here in South Africa, we can't kind of get our heads around it yet because it's very complex. But Turkey has, let me not try and paraphrase it, rather go and watch Iraj Abedian and that interview, and he really unpacks it well and provides excellent context. Industrials and financials were slightly firmer, and the top 40 index reflecting the improvement in resources, that was up by just under 1%. Bitcoin back above $100,000. A lot of the recent Bitcoin strength has come because of the appointment of David Sacks, who is, as mentioned earlier, from a Cape Town family going back many generations and now living in, well, he emigrated to the United States. The family is there as well. Bitcoin over $100,000. The intention there, or the belief there, is that it's going to be integrated into the financial system. They're even talking, I think it's either today or tomorrow, where Microsoft is going to consider having Bitcoin as part of its reserves. And, watch that price go if Microsoft decides to do that. The Rand, very strong today, 26% better against the dollar at 17 Rand and 70 cents, 77 cents, and 29 cents firmer against the pound at 22 Rand 70. So these geopolitical moves are counting in South Africa's favor. Maybe people are seeing this country becoming non-aligned again. Getting back to the biggest moving shares on the JSE, ArcelorMittal has really been under pressure. That was down 6% today, the biggest mover on the day, down 6.3%. Nampak up 6.1% was the biggest gainer. And Nampak has been the polar opposite to ArcelorMittal. That has been big winner this year, up 133%. Sibanye Stillwater 6% higher, but it's still lagging, almost a quarter down on the year as a whole. Mantengu Mining up 5% and Harmony Gold 4.9%. Both of those more than 40% to the good year to date. Shaftesbury Capital is a London company, London listed company. We have a secondary listing here on the JSE. It's a property business, down 4% here, no doubt because of the firmness of the Rand. Brait down 2.5%. It's also got a big exposure to the UK. And Anheuser-Busch, ABI InBev, down 1.8% or 20% lower on the year. And AB InBev is the only stock that is actually at a new low today. And there's a whole string of new highs, including Baldwin, Karoo, WeBuyCars, Tiger Brands, Omnia, Spar, even Naspers. Just quickly before we go, there was a disruption to flights in Johannesburg, and we've given you a picture of what it looked like at the board, the reason on the departure board, the reason for all those flights being posted with indefinite delays is there was a valve that broke and as a consequence, none of the flights could refuel. It was fixed later in the afternoon, so hopefully things getting back to normal again. And then there was a trading update, a date from Italtile, showing that although they're optimistic about the future, it's been a tough 5 months to the end of November. The retail sales of tiles only up by 2%, and their manufacturing division was down by about 2%. Well, that's it from the team for the night, for tonight. I thank you for being with us. Bronwyn will be back again hosting tomorrow evening. And until then, from our team to you, cheerio. This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to transactional banking with simple, transparent fees.